because he had a bubble with Pandora and Iggy and, oh God, Iggy and Takeo's. he had a bubble of like five people and I committed El Shai straight into that. And instead of killing him, he chose to disengage both Pandora and Candy and throw them at Kairos, which just left Borkman with like Iggy and baby Cade. And I'm like, yeah, I'll take those odds. Thank you. Because I was fully expecting to lose Borkman. But instead, Kairos held up five models for like three turns.
Amazing. We've got ourselves another path to podium. This is for an event back in July of last summer in Western Australia. We've got three players that made some very interesting choices in the crews they took and the plays that they made that allow them to finish at the top of the heap. If you play Karis, Seamus, Reva, or Colette, you're going to find a lot of interesting ideas shared. All three of these players have a very interesting approach that's really a testament to learning one crew and mastering it before you move on to other keywords. There's an account of a great matchup between Karis and Raspi. It's very interesting to hear how one of the players countered Yan Lo with Colette. You'll be shocked to find out the top table final round was Dreamer versus Reva, and Reva won. Be sure to stick around to the end to learn what Western Australia thinks about the game. So when they listen to podcasts and watch battle reports, they, you know, obviously are on a weird place and they're finding that there's a difference between evaluations of different keywords and models. There are certain models that they think are really good that everybody else in the world appears to think is garbage and vice versa. So don't miss the last segment. Sit back and learn about how these three players made the right decisions pre-game, during the game, and that allowed them to finish at the top. Enjoy!
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking to the podium for a recent in-person event in Australia. They had enough players that felt comfortable with the safety protocols in place to do what many of us miss terribly, and that's actually play a tournament in person. My guests are the three podium finishers. We've got Ewan Bailey-Teely, James Bryant, and Rebecca Lay. So Ewan, welcome to the Third Floor.
Thank you for having me.
So first time on the show, and I always like to get an idea from my my guest's first appearance, kind of how you got into this crazy hobby. So at one point in time, Ewan, you had no idea what tabletop gaming was, what miniature gaming is. What happened? How did you get introduced to it?
I got in quite young. I started when I was about 7 or 8, probably.
Wow.
My father always been a huge nerd. Especially fantasy. He got me reading Lord of the Rings as a child. And he went out and he bought the Two Towers and the Return of the King starter boxes for the Lord of the Rings.
Nice.
Hobby. We then split them, myself, my dad, and my older sister. And we played that hobby as a family for many, many years. The two of them slowly drifted out, but I kept going.
Very cool. I got to say, Ewan, of all of the games that GW put out, I still will argue that Lord of the Rings / The Hobbit is the best they've done.
Oh, absolutely. I love that.
Yeah, it's a good system. The models are gorgeous, especially if you love, you know, the source material. I think the only thing that that game has ever missed is some more interesting scenarios for match play. But their narrative scenarios that recreate scenes from the books and movies are fantastic.
Yes, one of my favorite memories is we played through all of them in a row. We did the entire Lord of the Rings story and matched it as best we could. But as I got older, I wanted more people to play with, and that transitioned into 40K and fantasy, which were a lot more popular at the time. And then from there, it was War Machine and Warmer Hordes, after I got a bit tired of them. And then X-Wing, then Malifaux, and most recently also Crisis Protocol.
Oh, I'm a huge MCP fan. That's great.
I'm loving it at the moment. I play it with my partner.
Yeah, it's a good game. It's a good game. It's not as deep and as heavy as Malifaux, but that's a good thing, not a bad thing, right? It gives you a chance to play something a little bit lighter.
Yeah, little easier on the brain.
Yeah, exactly. You don't feel just exhausted after playing it for 3 hours. So, James, welcome to the third floor.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, James, same question. How did you end up getting into this crazy hobby?
I've mentioned it before because I've been on here before. Malifaux was my first game. I'd never played any tabletop game before this one. I started in second ed, probably played it for about 3 years, and then went into third ed. I tried War Machine for a little bit. It just wasn't for me. I'm not a big fan of the dice. Didn't work for me. Malifaux's been the only one I've played, and it's pretty much the only one I've really liked.
So, James, I'm trying to remember from our previous conversation, how long did you play second ed?
I think it was about 3 years.
Okay. I couldn't remember if you were relatively new to second ed, but you went through the whole cycle of second edition.
Yeah, I've been in it for quite a while.
Good. And what is your kind of your hot takes on third edition? Are you happy with what they've done?
Oh, yeah, I'm enjoying it way more. I really enjoy the keyword system. I think that's probably my favorite change.
Yeah, I agree. Completely agree. So our third guest is Rebecca. Rebecca, welcome to the third floor.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And my pleasure. So Rebecca, how did you end up finding Malifaux or tabletop gaming in general?
Malifaux is actually also my first one. I found it through Ewan, who we've been friends for many, many years before that. And I think he was just getting into Malifaux when he told me about it, and it's similarly interesting. And then, and then he showed me a picture of Kaoris, and I was sold instantly.
Now, so Malifaux is your first mini game?
Yeah, it's I've only played one game of another type of mini game too. So, yeah.
Gotcha. So, in your mind, having never played mini games before, I mean, Malifaux is a pretty hardcore first one to pick up. What was the hardest thing to kind of get your mind around as you started playing for the first time?
I started so long ago, I don't really remember. I'll be honest. I started way back in M2E, in the first edition of M2E, I think it was. So, gotcha. I have no idea. It's been a while.
You're a veteran now, right? So. Well, how about your take on third edition?
I'm loving it. I pretty much honestly only play one master. So I'm one of those rare people who don't have tons and tons of crews. I just pretty much go-to Kaoris player. And I really love it. I honestly can say I probably would have stopped playing Malifaux if her crew didn't like hadn't worked for me. But I love it. I think it's great. I think it's a lot, not necessarily simpler, but it's a lot easier to kind of get into and sort of focus on what you're doing rather than like the 10 billion conditions that M2E had.
Yeah, I think that the I don't think they simplified it. They definitely streamlined it. What is cool about it is in some ways, I think it made the game deeper, which is no small feat to pull off. And as far as you soloing a master, first of all, must have been nice playing Kaoris in third edition versus second edition. She's a lot better.
I loved her in second edition.
But I feel like her power level went way up in third.
I mean, I agree. She's definitely stronger now, but I played her for pretty much 3 years only, so I could definitely make her work in second ed.
Yeah.
I have some painful memories of that.
you can attest to it.
I'm having flashbacks right now.
That's really funny. I think probably the best thing about people that focus on one or two masters is that you start actually very quickly playing Malifaux as opposed to just playing the crew. Because at this point, you probably know all the cards, you know all the triggers. I would imagine your activation order has become secondhand.
Oh, yeah. No, I pretty much. And I think that really is helpful for me because I tend to struggle when there's a lot going on because I can be a little scatterbrained. So for me, as long as I know what my crew is and what I'm doing with them, I know I'm okay because I can sort of figure out what's going on.
Yeah. Whenever I get, sometimes I'll get private messages and stuff of people that are struggling. Like I struggle, I suck at the game. That's the first thing I tell them, as I say, put all those models away and not only just pick a single master, but pick a set crew, just pick seven models.
Yeah.
and just keep playing it over and over and over again to the point where you get to where you are, Rebecca, where you can really concentrate on points and you can concentrate on tactics and things like that. So I think that's smart. So guys, one of the things that I wanted to talk about right out of the gate is because, and the reason I want to talk about this is because the vast majority of the listeners right now are really envious of you. Because most of us have not played a game in person, let alone a multi-person event. And it seems like a decade now, and it hasn't been quite that long, but, so I'd be curious to know, well, first off, what was the discussion out of the gate? Was there a message that went out locally that said, we're thinking of doing an event and what do people think about it? Like, how was the subject first broached?
I think in WA, Western Australia, sorry, it's quite different because we haven't had any community transition for like 90 days and everyone who has COVID are in quarantine.
Yeah.
And also our state has a hard border lock, so nobody can come in and out unless they're previously approved of. So it's sort of like there's no community transition. Restrictions are pretty much relaxed entirely.
Wow.
You know, we don't have to wear masks everywhere. And it's I feel like it's a very different situation than what's going on in the States.
What's the cost of living there, just out of curiosity? That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. It is pretty great.
Yeah. Now, of course, I'm in America, so there's no way I can't even leave my country now, let alone come to your...
WA is isolated even by Australian standards. So we're doing very strongly right now.
Yeah, and I think I remember that in the discussion when I had some of you guys on before. All right, so obviously that was a non-issue then, right? It was just kind of like, look, life is relatively back to normal. We don't have to necessarily have the safety protocols in place for the event itself because it's been, sounds like, taken care of at a much larger scale. Was there any adjustments made, Ewan, in the actual game itself? So was there any distancing or it doesn't sound like masks or even a thing?
No masks at all. We did have, there are some restrictions in our gaming venues as to how many people you're allowed to have in an enclosed space. So we had to, our henchmen did some work coordinating with the venue itself beforehand to ensure that we didn't have too many people, and as it's a store, to also leave enough room to allow them to continue their normal day-to-day operations as well.
We had a cap of 14 people, so even though we did have more interest for more people playing, the cap was 14 just to keep it safe.
That's cool. So the event ended up being 14?
Yep.
Yeah, down from 16.
Gotcha. Now, was this the first event you guys have had since all of this has happened?
Yes.
Yeah.
Got it. Well, very cool. Well, guys, we're going to take a quick break. When I get back from this break, we're going to take a look at round one and how each of our competitors did. We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats. Save yourself some money and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code. So let's talk about the first round. And Yuna, we'll start with you. But before we do that, let me give you guys kind of a breakdown. So it was a standard deployment. The strategy was recover evidence. The strategies, the schemes were let them bleed, research mission, spread them out, catch and release, and hidden martyrs. So Yuna, who did you match up against?
Funny story on that, actually. In the original matchup, I was meant to play James. However, Rebecca and James were late to the event, so I got rematched with James's opponent and with Rebecca's opponent, and then they got matched with each other. So things could have played out very differently if that had changed.
That's funny.
So I matched against a Hoffman player who's a good friend of mine. So I would played each other a couple of times before, so we were familiar with each other's tactics. And I chose to play Raver because I loved her alternate sculpt, so I had just started playing her purely for the purpose of using that model.
So I assume we're going to dig a little bit deeper into this, Ewan, but so you're one of those people that can actually win with Reva?
Well, yes, evidently.
Because, you know, I'm still in the camp where I can't make her work. So
I've gotten some work done with her.
That's good. That's good. Well, let's start off with then your scheme choices. What two schemes did you pick?
So I picked Let Them Bleed and Research Mission.
And why those?
Research Mission is trivial for Raver to achieve. You almost always take the Carrion Emissary in her list for the turn activation one. A Carrion Emissary can put a Mindless Zombie, I believe it's 19 inches effective, out from where it started. And that aggressive corpse placement is so strong for Raver. And in addition to that, a Pyre marker, a corpse marker, and a coffin marker, you've scored Research Mission without any other work. And that's, you can do that immediately.
Yep.
It's significantly easy. It's essentially an auto pick for a Raver if it's in the pool. It's just 2 points off the bat.
And with that flexibility, I would imagine you, and it's really hard for someone to even counter, isn't it?
Oh yeah. And like in this particular one, I took a Graveyard Spirit, which can put down corpse markers.
Yep.
And so it was able to just walked up the side of the board. I put a coffin over there, turn two, I think. I dropped a coffin, and then it was done. It just walked up there. Corpse marker with a bonus, scheme marker with an action, the coffin with a bonus from the emissary, and I've scored it already. And then the coffin stays there too.
Can you give us an idea what the rest of the crew looks like?
So the first thing is it was a 42 stone event, not a 50 stone.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot to mention that.
It made it very interesting to list build because it really forced me to prioritize a lot more than I normally do. So I ran Reva with the Whisper, which is a very powerful upgrade for her. She's such a strong offensive piece that knowing what you've got coming is, I think, really important. I'll often actually attempt and deliberately fail her bonus action just to cycle a bad card off the top of the deck. And then I ran the two candles, two Draugr, the Carrion Emissary, a Graveyard Spirit, and a Gravedigger with 6 stones.
Very nice. Very, very nice. So now your opponent was playing Hoffman. Was that Arcanist Hoffman or Guild?
Guild Hoffman.
Gotcha. So looking back on it, Ewan, what do you think was kind of the main decision points? At what point, if you look back on it now, did you secure the win?
Early on, actually. So my opponent had both the Peacekeeper and Joth on the team. Knowing that I'd have to get rid of two such offensive pieces, especially with offensive pieces with strong threat ranges, I'd have to get rid of them quickly. So Let Them Bleed was my other easy pick. Joth extended himself very early, and I had baited him with a Mindless Zombie that came out of the coffin marker, and then he killed it, but it turned into a corpse regardless. So then my opponent had no way to remove my corpses once I had them out on the field, and that happened before Raver's activation. So round one, Joth was on not looking good remotely. He was low health, as Raver's obviously got the ability to charge but then attack 8 inches out from that charge location plus a 2-inch range beyond that. So Joth died activation one, turn two, And then I actually ended up scoring Let Them Bleed on a different model, just because I figured I might as well get rid of him before he has the chance to heal or do damage. And there was a forest that was long ways down the board with the Peacekeeper deployed on one side of it, and I moved my whole crew to the other.
Nice.
So by using the Dense Terrate, I denied the Peacekeeper any offensive power until early turn three, when it was easy enough for me to deal with.
Well, and I would imagine you then really wasted some, Peacekeeper had to waste some AP to become relevant again, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the goal, because I have been on the receiving end of an angry Peacekeeper and never again.
So what did the final score end up being?
8-1.
Wow. Wow. Okay, great. So that's a nice first win. So Rebecca and James, they just lollygag in, taking their time, getting to the event. They finally arrive. And you guys are end up matched against each other. So Rebecca, I know you took Karis, but James, what did you bring?
So I played Colette for all three rounds.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's an interesting matchup. Now, I would imagine the two of you have had this matchup a million times between the two of you.
No.
Oh, really?
We actually haven't played. Yeah, we haven't played too much of GG1. This was actually only my second game of GG1. So wow. It was a learning curve.
I bet. So, well, first of all, who won?
I won. Mm. It was
James.
So I wish I could tell you this amazing story about how awesome this game was. But as we said, we were late. We had like less than an hour and a half to get this game done. And it was a bit of a mess. So the game was 3-1, I believe.
How many turns did you guys end up getting in?
2.5, if that. Yeah, we had to really rush the third turn just to sort of, so we kind of skipped activations that didn't matter. So we just sort of, the last turn was a mess. So
do you think, either of you, do you think it would have played out different if you'd had a full 5 turns and all the time to play?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah? Do you think it would have been closer, Rebecca, or do you think you would have taken it?
I don't think I would have taken it. James is very good, and Colette is a very difficult opponent.
Yeah.
She great crew, but I like the Karis matchup into Colette because Love, Super Laser, Glory, Circumvents, Distracted, and that's her main stick. So I like the matchup, and it would have just had to be dealing with the duet would have been my plus challenge, which I don't think I could have done.
Plus, Karis' ability to attack size does help take out Colette. She doesn't get her defensive trigger.
Oh, that's a good point. That means that you had to be much cagier with her than normal, huh?
Oh, yeah. Usually I just throw Colette to the problem like, yep, she's going to be fine.
Yeah, oh, I bet. So out of curiosity, so both of you guys soloed Masters for all three rounds. I'd be curious to know, start with you, Rebecca. How do you feel Karis does in Recover Evidence? Is that a strong one for her or is it a struggle?
I've only played 2 games of Recover Evidence, so I'm going to like take this with a grain of salt, but I'm not sure about it. I mean, I think Karis is probably one of the most adaptable and flexible masters in Arcanist, let alone probably the whole game, but I played 2 of Recover, and I don't think she kind of gets killy enough early. She's really good killing late, but I rarely kill models turn 2 unless I have Borgman up the front doing something, so... And then obviously the scheme marker drops, the strap marker, but by then I've got anyone that can interact with it off doing other things. So I don't know. Maybe it's just my playstyle, but also I think she's got stronger strategies than that.
Yeah. And how about Colette? Do you think Colette's strong, James, into the strat?
I love her in Recover Evidence. Colette's crew doesn't have tons and tons of damage, but she does have really good damaging models with the Corophy duet. And I also hired the effigy with the grow upgrade, and he's pretty punchy. So like the crew can get damage, but while it's not its focus, it can get good damage. So I find that I just need to pick targets one at a time to get the strategy markers. But once they're down, I've got Don't Mind Me. I've got ways to like just teleport my models and my opponent's models. I find it very, very easy to pick them up once they're down.
Yeah, I would imagine that's the case. All right, so we've got James and Ewan with a win, and Rebecca, you got a loss, but I have a feeling we got some wins in your future. So let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about round 2. It's a wedge deployment, Symbols of Authority. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all.
crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com, that's with one M, or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code Third Floor Friend, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. All right, so round two, we've got Rebecca. I want to start with you because you're coming into it with a loss, so it's actually absolutely critical for you to make podium. You need to win your next two games. I mentioned before the break, it's a wedge symbols of authority round. The schemes were Breakthrough, Assassinate, Hidden Martyrs, Leave Your Mark, and Sabotage. So for Karis, Rebecca, what did you think were your two strategies? What did you pick?
I picked Breakthrough pretty much instantly. I think it's one of Karis's strongest strategies. And I also picked Leave Your Mark. And oh, I did nice. That because, unfortunately, the player I was playing against is a little bit of a newer player and he didn't have the Ice Golem. And I looked at his list and I was like, absolutely no one here is going to contest Borkman and holding the center of the board. So I'm gonna do Leave Your Mark. Otherwise, I probably would have gone Sabotage.
Right. So it was Arcanist on Arcanist, it sounds like.
Yes, it was. And also, unfortunately for him, Raspi is the one other master that I sort of do play. So I was very familiar with what his crew can do.
That and having knowledge of, I mean, you don't have to, I mean, the fact that you play Raspi helps considerably, but even just having a general knowledge of the other opponent can be a huge advantage. One of the reasons I encourage people to listen to deep dives, even if it's not your master, because you can at least walk away from it having a general understanding of how the mechanics of it work. So same type of idea, Rebecca, when you look back on that, when do you think was the turning point? When did you think that a win was in your future?
Probably, again, pretty early, because he really aggressively deployed two December Acolytes and he really aggressively deployed them. So I had Karis kill one. I left it on one health, but it had burning. So I was just like, you're fine. And then I had Carlos kill the other one. And then by the start of turn two, I put Borgman into the center of the board to kind of bait in either Snowstorm or Blessed, because I knew Blessed would be a problem. Yep. He committed Borgman. I won initiative and he killed Blessed in one go. So I was like, this is it. You know, I've killed three of his models, yeah. So this is downhill from here for him.
And taking out those Acolytes is huge because, one, it obviously hurts the scheming ability if your opponent had any plans of doing that. Plus, those Acolytes are a damage threat, too.
Yeah. So, as soon as he put them there, I was just like, I would really like to kill them.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, and again, this is not to be a broken record, but having meta knowledge about Raspi allows you to be much smarter in picking your targets, right? Your target priority is easy because you know what you like to keep alive, which means that's what you want to kill on the other side. So yeah. That makes sense.
It was also very much, I do know the December crew's weaknesses. I think that they have really huge weaknesses and Karis's crew is a quick one, which is one of their biggest. So I was just like, I'm going to run them around the map and she's not going to be able to keep up.
I think Raspi has a strong keyword. I think that in the right hands, Raspi, especially in the right pool, Raspi can be just oppressive. But I also consider her a high skill cap master.
She's very difficult.
She's very difficult, and she has a bit of a reputation of being a quote unquote weak master. But I think that that's just a situation where people haven't put in the reps. Because I've seen Raspi in the right hands, and it really sucks. It's really not fun to play against.
Yeah, no, like if you can get your first turn focus shoot off and apply slow into a bubble, that changes the whole game from turn one.
Completely agree. So James, let's talk about your round. We know you brought Colette. Who did you play against?
I versed Yanlo.
Which version, 10 or Rezzer?
I honestly don't remember, but he didn't take any upgrades or out of keyword models, so that doesn't matter.
Didn't matter. Okay.
Who was the player, James?
Ben.
Brotherson.
Okay.
Ben's brother.
Gotcha. So, well, first of all, I assume you won.
Yes, I did. The total score was 8-4, my favor.
Wow, another nice margin. So, first of all, of the schemes, which ones did you pick and why?
So I took Leave Your Mark and Breakthrough. So I love Breakthrough and just schemes that favor my amazing movement with Colette. She's got a lot of movement tricks, pin her down. You've got models that don't mind me, the ability to presto change her models away and just nimble on the Corifee is always amazing. And the Corifee was a big thing for scoring my Breakthrough, because once I got her in the backboard, with the ability to dance apart and just go two different separate ways, you've always got a model in the enemy's deployment zone and you can get your schemes down so easily. Breakthrough and
the Corifee are so strong as scheme runners because they're such a threat. It's so often when you have an aggressive scheme runner that's going into your backfield, it's not that big of a deal because you just wipe them off the board. If I see a Corifee coming into my backfield, I've got some big decisions to make, because the Corifee is like, you know, I could scheme or I could just kill all of your crew, whichever you'd prefer.
Yeah, both work for me. Like, even if you're just not looking at the duet, just the single Corifee, it's a set defense 6, stat 6 attack. 2, 4, 5 damage. Yeah. Like, it's going to do work with Nimble. So it gets to move for free, charge, two attacks. You don't want to go near it.
It's a very, very flexible. Cause you obviously know when you need them combined, and they're valuable when they're not combined, which I think is good. So looking back on it, James, what do you think was probably one of the key moments when you realized that you were probably going to win this match?
So one of my favorite things to do was Symbols of Authority. Now, I'm an Arcanist player, so I'm going to hire a silent one. That's just crazy not to. So I love their ability to, like, just wedge a symbol into a corner and then just drop. So first turn, ice pillar, and just block in those symbols so people can't get into them without putting in a bit of extra work. I know I'm an awful person. but some big...
Which, you guys, for listeners, James can see my webcam as we're discussing, and he just sees the Arcanist hate on my face. But go ahead, James.
Another bigger point was early turn 2. So turn 1, I had the Corifee duet up in his deployment, staring down Yanlo and Chiaki. I just went straight for Chiaki. She was my first kill. Like, beginning of turn 2, Chiaki dead. Big change. And then the rest of that, I just basically ignored Yanlo. I just kind of took care of his models. He was very aggressive with an Ashigaru, which was his hidden martyr. I just gave him that point. But I found that I stayed away from his Izamu the Armor, a really slow beater. And I found that my mobility and a couple of cheeky ice pillars, I could just stay away from him and just, you can chase me if you want, but you're not going to succeed. A very, very big thing was I killed Chiaki, danced apart my Corifee. He did get his, I just said his name, Izamu. He just got Izamu into a Corifee, and he cheated a Red Joker to hit, obviously with the armor piercing trigger, which is like Corifee's main defensive tech, and then Black Joker the damage.
Yep.
So I was ready to lose this Corifee. I'm like, I'm just going to lose this Corifee and then use the other Corifee to scheme. I didn't need to do that. I just got to keep my Corifee duet. So that was a big change for me.
That's nice. And I got to tell you, James, your approach to how to handle Yanlo, I think, is a strong approach, which is one, there's a lot of key decision points. One is whether you're going to deal with Yanlo or not deal with him. And I think both are valid depending on what crew you're bringing. But with a Colette crew, I like your decision of saying, look, I'm going to ignore him and just deal with the fact that, you know, by turn 4, Yanlo is going to be an insane god and I need to, you know, take care of as much things early. I also like your target priority. Taking out Chiaki early is a very strong move. So well done, man.
Yeah, I've versed Ben's Yanlo twice, and every single time I've just taken Chiaki out straight away.
Yeah, she is, in my opinion, she's one of the top target priorities when you go up against Yanlo. So nice victory, man. So now let's talk to you and you. And did you win your match?
I did, yes.
Nice. 5-3. 5-3. Nice win. So what schemes did you take?
I ended up taking Assassinate and Hidden Martyrs.
Go ahead.
I was running Seamus this round, which I'm now a little sad of, because originally I went into this event intending to 3-round Raver as a sort of a joke challenge that I'd been assigned by our meta. But I had done a fully converted Red Chapel crew just that week.
Nice.
And so I wanted to play them. So it was my second actual game with Seamus ever, was round 2 of this event. So I think I was feeling a little confident after the 8-1. I was prepared to take some risks.
Yeah.
And so I ran him into Euripides.
Oh, wow.
So Seamus is obviously insanely good at symbols of authority. The mobility that he has, his crew making each other more mobile, it's just Seamus and the his totem alone, the copycat killer, can easily threaten 3 to 4 symbols turn 2 if they want to. That being said, I only scored 1 point off the strategy the whole game.
Wow.
My opponent was within 6 inches of my deployment zone on the first turn, thanks to Wedge and Garion's throwing people through ice pillars. I had a lot of stuff to deal with quite quickly.
So I'd be curious, June, because that's when you said Euripides and I looked at the pool, I'm like, ooh, that's a good choice and tough for you. What crew? So let's talk about the crew that you brought with Seamus, because with Seamus, you have a lot of options because Seamus can be very good out of keyword with just out of keyword and versatile models. Did you stay in keyword?
Almost entirely. I ran 2 dead doxies, a single Rotten Bell who died very early on, didn't help me very much, Betty Noir, and the Carrion Emissary.
Ooh, you brought that. Very nice. And you said the Carrion. Okay, that's good. So in your mind, what was... Well, first of all, how did you deal with that aggressive move by the Euripides player?
So early on, he obviously moved Euripides up board and started showering me in ice pillars. I was able to pass a few of those jewels quite luckily, but I did lose my totem early on, which is part of why I suffered on symbols, because I no longer had...
Right.
That free activation to walk into the backfield and score later. I lost that ability to get Seamus both in the fight and scoring, which I love about the Red Chapel playstyle.
Yeah.
So once those pillars were up, he was able to teleport one of his Garions in, but Seamus hadn't activated. And the pillars, while obviously blocking up my crew, free up an incredible number of targets for Seamus to move to. They're all correct. Blocking impassable, so I was spoiled for choice on Secret Passage. I did make a small kerfuffle and a learning point on Seamus here, where I failed to kill the Garion with Seamus because I didn't think about... I had the opportunity to cheat for a trigger, and I chose not to, which left the Garion on 1 health because it's hard to kill, because I was out of action. If I had cheated for the trigger, I would have been able to push the Garion into Seamus's engagement and make the free attack, which... That's the kill. That's the point I would have needed because I couldn't. I had the 1 action left, so I would have gotten 2 attacks to kill the Garion. But I could not simply charge the Garion thanks to its extended reach. So that's a learning point.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon. I'll tell you, I did not unlock Seamus and make Seamus effective for me until I learned how to take advantage of him in close combat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy and obvious to see what a ranged threat he is, but when you learn to leverage him with melee attacks and taking advantage of his ability to get a free attack when things are pushed into him, not only with his ability to do it, but with the doxies and stuff like that, I think that's when you truly unlock Seamus.
He's such an offensive threat, especially with injured. It's one of the strongest conditions in the game, in my opinion.
Couldn't agree more. All right, guys. Well, that gives us an idea of how round 2 went. We're going to take a quick break. Let's go into round 3. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Alexander Zdanchuk from Riga, Latvia, and I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars. Those guys open the beauty of Malifaux 3rd Edition to me and continue to provide tons of great content. You can support them too. Follow the links in the show notes below or search for Third Floor Wars at patreon.com.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth $1 a month? $5 a month? $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go by our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week. Hey, need to give a special shout out to some of our newest patrons. A big thanks goes out to Bob Fletcher, Old Doc Fulton, Joseph Pye, Loke Walmo, Nicholas Prinzing, Dareth8952, Sven Hoffman, Mike Schmidt, and Peter DeArmas. The only reason we're able to put out content on a regular basis is because of you guys and gals. Thanks a ton.
So round three, we've got both James and Ewan 2-0, and you guys didn't end up facing each other, which helps the chances of both of you making podium, of course. But Rebecca, you're back in again to another key matchup. That's the, when you're playing in a three rounder, especially with as many as 14 players, losing the first game of all the games is the one to lose, right? If you're going to go 2-1, you want to learn, lose that first game, get hopefully a more favorable matchup round two, but then you're right back into the mix in round three and have to win that. So let's start first of all with the pool. It's flank public enemies. Oh, Karis is so good in public enemies.
Yeah.
Flank public enemies. The pool is Vendetta, Spread Them Out, Sabotage, Take Prisoner, and Claim Jump. So, Rebecca, first off, what was the score?
It ended up being 6-5 to me. It was very close. And the only reason I was on third table, and that was because I did so well the previous round, which was good. But yeah, no, it was 6-5. But unfortunately, it was into Pandora, which is it's not a victory. When he announced Pandora, I was like, okay, because I personally consider Pandora as possibly Karis's worst matchup.
It's a terrible matchup.
Because it's as soon as he announced, I was like, oh, this is going to be like something. This is going to be very fun for me.
Yeah.
And except it's not going to be. But so as soon as he did that, I knew I couldn't play Karis conventionally, because if I had played like I normally do, you know, like setting up the pyres, standing in the pyres, using Blaze, I would be instantly killed. Pretty much, or yo-yoed around the board. So, I ended up taking Sabotage and Claim Jump with the Fire Starter.
And did you bring the Fire Golem?
No, I pretty much never play the Fire Golem. Because,
oh, really?
Yeah, it's a great model, but also I just rate Borgman so much higher. And honestly, as soon as I put the golem on the board, my opponents look at the model and say, we must kill that. Whereas Borgman's like, it's just a dude with a sword, right? He'll be fine.
That's funny.
It's like, the golem is great, but I also find its armor is too conditional almost. I'd rather Borgman's guaranteed -1 damage every time rather than the golem's like, you have to, like, with, like, the golem had 9 burning in a game I played against. Ewan's Rever, the golem died turn two with 9 burning. He just went straight through it. So
that makes some sense. So let's talk about key moments. Where do you think you eked out that win?
I didn't really know up until it was very, very, very close. It kind of came down to the wire, really. It was 6-4, I think. But yeah, because I was able to sneak Eljaya past into, because he had a bubble of Pandora and Iggy and, oh God, Iggy into Karis. he had a bubble of like 5 people, and I committed Eljaya straight into that. And instead of killing him, he chose to disengage both Pandora and Candy and throw them at Karis, which just left Borgman with like Iggy and Baby Kate. And I'm like, yeah, I'll take those odds. Thank you. Because I was fully expecting to lose Borgman. But instead, Karis held up 5 models for like 3 turns.
Amazing.
So, yeah, it's actually why I always put magical training on her, because if she doesn't take any damage, the shield circumvents the burning at end of turn. And Counterspell is just that nice little extra. Yes, you have to discard this card so that you can, like, screw me over.
Yep.
You're going to do it, but, like, you still have to pay that resource for it. So, yeah. I had a silent one backing her up, but I don't tend to pull very good heals. So it's pretty much all Kara is holding up.
Yeah, shutting that ability to force your opponent to either not go for the trigger or to have the their resource pressure of their control hand is powerful. I think it's an underestimated counterspell. I think it's an underestimated ability in the game because it does what I love to do, which is force my opponent to make one of two bad decisions, and both of them suck. So that's great.
Yeah. I mean, unless you got like a 1 in your hand, you're like, yeah, it's a 1.
Well, yeah, but and people, and this is where I always talk about people. Like, you read that, and in your head, they're like, oh, they're just going to discard low cards. And that's where Theory Foe fails you, because in reality, depending on when it comes into action, they may have long gotten rid of those low cards. And you put them again in a position. And also, it's a good counter pick to a lot of crews that depend on their triggers.
Yeah, it is. It's very good.
Yeah, very good.
But yeah, I feel like the game probably swung when I managed to kill Candy, because before that, I had to discard like he just kept not activating her, and I had to discard like four cards out of my like six card hand to just activate my models. But it was actually it made because I was able to up we go with Chaos through stun, slow, and some other condition that was probably terrible. So she had two AP, and I was just, I'm just going to focus and up we go.
Yeah.
And so I managed to get her out of engagement, which meant the Firestarter recklessed over a building and took two shots and killed her.
Nice.
So, yeah, it made us laugh because everyone was like, oh, the worst henchman killing the best. And I'm like, yeah. But I love them.
Candy's good. Candy's good. And a good, good target
the
priority.
Word I'm using?
Yeah, good target priority.
I knew I needed to kill her. Well, my first target was actually the totem, because it can remove markers.
Yep.
And then it was Iggy, because Iggy.
Yep.
And then it was Candy, because Candy.
The more you're talking, Rebecca, the more I realize what a terrible matchup that is for you. So
it's bad.
Yeah, well done. Well done. Thank you. Nice win. Secures you third place, which is awesome. Let's talk about our second place finisher. So, James, what was your matchup?
So I was playing, again, Colette into Lady J for Public Enemies.
Ooh.
Yeah, I was quite happy about this one. So in the end, the game was 4-1. In hindsight, I picked Spread Them Out. And in hindsight, that was probably not the best idea to pick, because I went into it planning to play defensively. I knew that I couldn't just throw myself at Lady Justice with her being such a killer crew. I needed her to come to me, and I needed to make her play my game. I also didn't take Angelica, so I had no way of just throwing scheme markers where I needed them to be. I should have taken which one was it? I should have taken Claim Jump. Like, I love Claim Jump. I don't know why I didn't take it, and Colette is really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's what happened. So I also took Vendetta. Arcane Emissary against the Death Marshal. I love the Emissaries for Vendetta. You take the grow upgrade, and it went from being a 4-point model versus a 5-point model to being a 10-point model versus a 5-point model. And the Death Marshal was such a great pick because it got hard to kill. So I can just, what I did was I presto changeoed the Death Marshal into my back line next to my Emissary. And the Emissary could just go ham because I don't have to worry about killing it thanks to hard to kill. So it's like, well, easy Vendetta point.
Yeah, and I'd be curious to know, James, so one, I mean, knowing that you've got that grow upgrade, and obviously your opponent knows they have it on there, how do you protect the effigy?
So my plan is always just, I just put the effigy as far back as I possibly can. And great thing about Colette is her presto changeo is any friendly model, not a performer, so I can presto changeo my effigy in worst case scenario. Like usually like turn one, I'll stay back there and I'll focus. And then maybe turn at the end of turn two, I'll run up. Or I just leave him back there and again, presto, change him up when I need him. So I think she's really good with the growing one just because she has ways to move that model as far as she needs it to go. And then again, because I had to play defensively, so I was able to I just kind of forced Lady J to stay back with my stun triggers and ice pillars, and I just tried to keep her back as long as I could.
Now, was there any decisions that the Lady J player made that ended up working to your advantage?
He gave me the Lone Marshal. And he gave me the Death Marshal as well.
Yeah.
So the Death Marshal came really close. He was like just hiding behind cover. He came close. I'm like, all right, presto changer, you're out of here. And then I was able to throw Colette into the Lone Marshal. Obviously, Colette's got a 2-inch melee, which I love, stat 7, and then stunned. So he couldn't just use his bonus actions to get out of there. He was stuck engaging Colette.
Right. Now, did both Colette and Lady J survive turn 5?
I didn't kill Lady J. I didn't even try. I used my Corophy to bait Lady J. So like Lady J would attack my Corophy. The Corophy would run away, heal, go back in, run away, heal. It was kind of like just back and forth with the Corophy. I killed only, I got 2 points for the strategy because I killed, even though I killed 3 models, I didn't kill enough on each turn. So like I couldn't score turn 3. I was only scoring turn 2 and 4. But I could like live as well.
What's frustrating about Public Enemies for me, and I'm granted, this is basically a hot take because I don't think I've even played Public Enemies. I've only talked to people about it and read it. But scoring 2 points is a win with Public Enemies because you're trying to do more than that just by the sheer nature of how the strategy works is it tends to be a win more. All right. So that third point, if you get a third point on Public Enemies, you've already won the game. You didn't need that third point because you've obviously have dominated the board. So I consider getting 2 points on that to be good. But nice win in second place for you, James.
Oh, thank you. I find that even more true in a 42-point crew, just because there's less targets for you to get.
Oh, sure.
So I mean, I'm happy with. I'm happy. It was a win. I can't complain about that. He only killed one model, so my defensive play worked really well.
Yeah. Well, I was about to say one model against a Lady Jake, we're only losing one model. That's a good sign. All right, let's talk to our... Go ahead, James.
I just love Klett's survivability and her ability to deny enemies with stunned. Stunned and distracted is so good.
Are you trying to trigger me, James?
Pardon?
I said, are you trying to trigger me with how good Arcanists are?
Most certainly, yes. I don't know if they Soulstone models to do it.
Well, don't you know, if you watch the internet, Soulstone miners are useless now. They aren't. Spoiler alert, they're not. They're really good still.
Yeah.
But now they're at least reasonable.
They're still amazing for denial. I do think they went a little bit too far, but I mean, the making them, like, nerfing them was needed. Definitely needed.
Yeah.
But I just love, they're still good for denial.
They're still good models. They're just not a model that you're going to... Before, it was, does an Arcanist take one or two? That was the decision maker. Now they have to actually decide whether they take them or they don't, which is where I want every model in the game. Yeah, exactly. So let's talk to our big winner. So Ewan, first of all, what did you bring?
I brought Raver again against Dreamer.
Nice. Look at you. Against Dreamer.
Yes, against Dreamer. This one won a little bloody. It ended 5-1, my favor, at top table.
Wow. And that's at top table. So your opponent obviously is a good player as well.
There was a few things early on that really swung it in my favor. And as you said, in Public Enemies, once you've started scoring, it can steamroll. So I ended up with 3 points from Public Enemies and 2 from Vendetta.
Nice.
So I ended up picking Vendetta with Vincent against Teddy. I hired Vincent without thinking of this. Normally he's a bit of a 50-50 pick for me. But with a willpower of 7 and a terrifying crew and exorcism on his crossbow, it was a immediate take straight away. The fun part of this game, which I really enjoyed, is the board setup actually became crucial to the coast of the game. We were playing on a board that James actually provided, a Wild West town that had a gallows dead center of the board. So it was a height 2 blocking piece of terrain right in the middle of the board on a flank deployment. So that immediately almost split the game into 2 mini crews fighting each other on either side of that piece of terrain. Early on, my opponent made a poor choice, which involved Teddy getting practically into my deployment zone turn 1.
Wow.
And unbeknownst to him at the time, Teddy was my Vendetta target. Right. So he handed me 2 points turn 1, which I claimed with no reservation. Activation 1 of turn 2 was Vincent. Teddy was already on about 4 health at that point. Vincent shot him once to score it, and then just focused because they didn't want to kill him yet. I scored Vendetta. My opponent desperately ran up Serena, healed Teddy, but Serena's a great healer, but Reva sitting on a pyre marker will kill whatever she needs to. And she did immediately. From there, Serena's now halfway up the board, completely exposed. She died later that turn, and that's one of his best beaters and Serena down. Bad start. Also, I was lucky because those two were both killed by different models. So I had the bounty points spread out across my crew a lot more comfortably. And what I did, as I mentioned, that game was split by that central piece of terrain. I used my Draugr to both my Draugr engaged Chompy Bits and that side of his force. They were doing a swimming job. One of my Draugr ended up on 1 health 3 times during the game, and every time it healed back through Juggernaut. And Raver is incredible under Public Enemies. Embrace the Flame with quick action on the amount of burning her crew gets on themselves does a lot of work just to heal up a model. As Specky can attest from our Kairos versus Raver game, I did a lot of work with that one.
Yeah, I bet. You know, it's funny, Ewan, hearing how that went down, that there's a very interesting decision point there for the Dreamer player. And it's something that I think that players don't think about enough. So here's the situation. He's overextended Teddy. He now knows Teddy is the Vendetta target. And
there's an argument that at some point you have to cut your losses. You have to say, you know what? Teddy's done. Those points are scored. And I don't want to throw good chips after bad. And you could argue that him extending out Bowman at that point was just compounding the initial mistake that was made. And that's not always true, but it's something that I think players need to think about a little bit, because a lot of second level play can be saying, look, I screwed up or I got unlucky. That's done. I just need to admit to myself that those points are scored, that model is lost, whatever it is, and I need to adjust now. Whereas the temptation is to try to make up for that mistake or make up for that bad flip and end up pushing and compounding the problem. I'm not criticizing the Dreamer player. That's a hard decision to make.
Absolutely. The strength also is Vincent basically didn't leave my deployment zone for the rest of the game. He was able to just, he took pot shots at summons and just stayed back there focusing. If he had nothing else to do, it became, especially with Agile, even if my opponent did get a model back there, the henchman with Agile, with Raver nearby. Raver didn't take a walk action or a charge action for the entire game.
Always good.
She just sat there doing what she does best, which is putting out pain and massively healing her crew. I made quite an unfortunate error, however, in this game, which did cost me a few points. I announced Claim Jump on my Carrion Emissary, which was my other scheme. Because I'd seen that large central piece of terrain, I knew the Carrion Emissary would be able to sit up there with flight, use cover markers to block off other models. Easy, easy points, easy score. I announced it turn two, but I didn't realize my opponent had a model physically on the other side of that terrain.
Oh,
I didn't
no.
see as a human. So I went, oh yeah, claim jump. And he went, no, you don't. And at that point, it's over. At that point, I had no chance of getting that claim. Chumpy was on that carrying emissary within half a turn. It was done on those. So I had to, as you said, I just had to cut those losses and go, I'm going to get my other points. I wasted a full turn of Chumpies by having both my Draugr use Draw a Flame on my Corpse Candles. So I'd move my Corpse Candles early, and then I'd resummon them after they died. But I'd brought them back and positioned them at the intersecting point of the line of sight of that central terrain piece on fire. So my Draugr was suddenly able to teleport 8 inches and then charge Sereno, and that's how I killed Sereno. And suddenly Chumpy and Alp and the Dreamer are on the wrong side of the board to participate. And that's a favorite strategy of mine, which I employed in round one as well. Just deny AP to your opponent.
That's always good. And what you did there is an exact example of what we were talking about, right? Where you said, look, the temptation would have been, because massive screw up, right? You declared a scheme and didn't score. That's a bad move. But what you could have done is said, you know what? I'm going to force the issue. What I'm going to do is I'm going to resource and clear out the center and then resource some more to keep the center thing so I can score my points. I think the smart decision is to do exactly what you did, which is said, you know what? I messed up. I'm not going to get points for this, and I'm not going to waste any more time, effort, and resources doing it. I'm going to focus elsewhere, and it ended up winning you the game, which I think is a nice move.
Absolutely. The one point my opponent scored was from public enemies via that. They got that one kill, they got the 2 points, and they scored it late in turn three. I got 2 from Vedetta, 3 from public enemies once I was able to. The other disadvantage of a summoner in public enemies is you're just feeding models. And Vincent was just going, oh, you summoned a stitch together. 2 points. You summoned whatever, points, points. I was stoning there quite regularly just to be like, done.
Vincent's a strong tech piece, and I think that depending on what the crew and the pool is, can be a strong tech piece even out of keyword.
Absolutely.
The only thing I would love to see when we get another wave of keyword models is I would love to see Reva get a henchman that I would take every time, because I don't think you take Vincent every time, but he can be critical, a critical tech piece higher like you showed.
In 50 stone lifts, I take Asura every time with the Whisper, and I normally have... I run high stones, but when I run Asura, I'm normally running 8 to 9 stones.
Wow. Yeah. She's resource intensive. I still haven't figured her out yet. And when I say figured her out, I can't decide whether she fits my play style or not. I hate how resource intensive she is, but it can pay off.
Yeah. Just flooding the board with corpses forever is helpful.
Yep. I agree. Well, guys, that's great. Congratulations on the podium. What we're going to do is we're going to take one more break. When we get back from this break, I've got 3 people from Western Australia that allow Reva to win a tournament.
So no one allows me to do anything.
That's right. I do want to find out, though. I love it when I talk to a meta. I like to get an idea of how the game's played there. What are some of the things that dominate the meta, things that they think is unique about their play? So we're going to come back and we're going to talk about what it's like to play in Western Australia. We'll be right back.
Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.
So for those of you that have been playing Malifaux for a while, especially if you listen to a lot of the media, one of the things that was always funny in second edition is there was a constant on forums and on a weird place. There was a constant kind of poking between the US and Australia. I think the centerpiece of that joke, I think it was around Parker, because at one point everybody in the US decided Parker was garbage. And then everybody in Australia apparently thought Parker was OP. Oh, yeah. And I'm being a little facetious. It wasn't that extreme, but it was the kind of the centerpiece of it. But it was a nice little rivalry. I'd like to get a sense, though, from the three of you, and Rebecca, we'll start with you. Is there anything that you think is unique to your meta? What is something that maybe makes Western Australia a little bit different than the rest of the world when it comes to Malifaux?
I'm not really sure. I do know that we do have a lot of players. Like, we've got a really active meta. Like, I mean, our tournaments regularly reach like 16 to 18 people.
That's great.
Busy nights can reach like, you know, 8 to 10 players. That's on our regular nights. And yeah, so we've got a lot of players, which means we tend to play a lot of different masters. So rather than like having just a small knit group, which is really good, and I certainly have players in our meta that I do prefer to play. But yeah, so we do have a really wide range of people. There aren't many guild players. There are a couple, but they're definitely probably the least represented. We have a lot of Bayou. In terms of like models in general, I think I fully convinced most of the Perth meta that the Firestarter is an incredible model. Whereas if you go on the forums, absolutely no one thinks that. And I mean, I really rate him. I think he's excellent. He's a move 7 henchman, and it's like he can go 21 inches across the board. He can go 14 inches and then scheme. He's good.
How would you rate him as the wind gammon?
Oh.
So, Rebecca, do you think that from a – and obviously there's a huge variation here with that many players, but do you think there's an aggressive style of Malifaux, or is it a more schemey style of Malifaux in Perth?
I think aggressive.
Okay.
I think I definitely fall more on the schemey side. I generally pick very non-interactive schemes. The amount of times I've taken Vendetta, I can probably count on my hand. I don't tend to take Assassinate. Like, I take the ones where I'm just like, Carlos and Firestarter can go deal with that, and I'll just hold up the rest of the crew and counter scheme and all that. So I sort of, I'm on the schemey side, but I do think it's quite aggressive.
Yeah. James, is there anything that you read in a weird place, or anything that you hear on a podcast, or anything that makes you question if the rest of the world is playing the same game you are in Perth?
Well, there's definitely that Firestarter thing, which we like to laugh at. We've also got a few debates about how the changes affected Tara and Hannah. I still think Tara is a great pick. I see people talk about how she's dead, it's over, Tara's useless, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I might be taking it a bit far, but, you know, people really, really hammered on how badly they've hit Tara. And I don't think that's the case. She's definitely not the powerhouse she was in GG1. And that's more of a GG0, sorry. And that's more of a reflection on the schemes themselves and her. But she's still a good master, without doubt.
Yeah, and I think that I agree with you about the conventional wisdom, right? The conventional wisdom now is that she's, you know, she's going to collect dust. And I think it's a combination of two things. One, obviously, the the changes impacted her and her keyword. I think the biggest impact, to your point, James, was the change from 0 to 1 in the pools. But I think a good bit of the argument is not necessarily that Terra's terrible now. It's just that other Outcast masters outshine her in almost every pool. Do you think that there's a scenario where Terra is the right pick if you have access to all of the keywords?
I mean, I might be biased because I just love her
keyword. That's okay.
And how she played. but I still love her in which one is it? Symbols of Authority is one I love for her. She's really good at Symbols of Authority. And I also really, this might sound weird, but I kind of like her into Recover Evidence just a little bit, because you can trick people into like, oh, you can't bury these models if I put markers on them. It's like, okay, cool. I'm just going to play models like, I'm more happy to play Talos than I was before.
Interesting.
Because he's a slow model. One of his hardest things is he couldn't keep up with a burying and unburying crew, and now he doesn't need to. Nothing Beast has got another great bonus action in his Cloud of Concealment. Again, it's not like if you can, you're forcing people to think, okay, I'm going to stop you from playing how you want to play by putting these markers on these models. It's like, well, I want you to put these markers on these models. Right. That's why I've brought these models.
Very, very interesting.
And I think that's something that have power.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you, man. I don't disagree with you at all. And again, you know, you're talking about you loving her. That's enough, right? And that's part of what I kind of like about Malifaux in general. And it gets to the Firestarter conversation we have, the Reva conversations we've had, is that the game is so layered that there's no right answers in Malifaux, which is part of what I love about the game and where I think Malifaux excels over Guild Ball. It's very hard to have a differing opinion in Guild Ball and have both be valid, right? Because in Guild Ball, and this is a tribute to how clean the game is, but you can almost empirically prove that one model is better than the other or one move is better than the other in Guild Ball. You can't do that in Malifaux.
It's my advice to new players is always like, which mask do you like the look of the most? Great, play that one. They're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. Like, sure, there might be some pools that you're going to be a little, you know, your crew's not the most optimal for. But I mean, I played Mark II KOs for 3 years and like nothing else. You'll be fine.
Well, yeah. And what I like about that too, Rebecca, is that if you play a pool that's not favorable to your keyword, and even if you lose, you're going to come out of it better at that keyword than when you started it.
It's actually, you learn so much more playing into a non-optimal scheme and strat than you do playing like the best list into the best everything. Like, sure, Sandeep might be the power pick of the Arcanists, but like also if you're not, if you don't know him that well, then your best pick is going to be the master you know the best. It always is,
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I definitely felt the same in Second Dead. Because I played nothing but Jackdaw, and even in the games where he's not supposed to work, I just made him work because I played him so much and nothing.
It's always going to trump anything else. Is your familiarity with the crew is always the number one indicator of your win-loss, in my opinion. Everything else can impact it, but the more familiar you are with the crew, the better chances you have of winning, whether the pool is favorable or not. How about you, Ewan? What is something that is truly signature in your mind for your area?
I think we have a great variety of players in terms of what we want out of the game. As you might have been able to guess, when we say, and I picked Reva because of her model, I only picked up Sheamus right before a tournament because Rebecca and I came up with the idea of converting his crew to be characters from Chicago the Musical.
Oh, and that's awesome.
So I did his henchmen, the two dead doxies and the three rotten bells. I converted each of them to clearly reference one of the murderers in Cellblock Tango, put cell bars behind them, and wrote signs with pop, six, so on and so forth. There were kill words from the musical behind them. So I had a lot of fun with that. And that's the only reason I played them, because I'm like, oh, I just made these cool models. I'm going to do it. I've recently...
Fantastic.
I recently picked up Molly as a part of a prize from the event as well. And I'm like, oh, I'm playing Molly now, but I'm going to do something cool. So I ended up doing submerged resin bases, which I recently put on Weird Place after I finished.
I saw those. I did not realize that was you. Very clever.
Thank you. So, and now I'm playing Molly. Now I'm a Molly player now. the joke is that I can no longer pretend I'm not a Reza player when I have three full keywords, all of which have converted or custom bases. It's too late. I used to be a Bayou player, but not anymore.
I'm glad you're not a Bayou player. Bayou players are my new Arcanists. So you and a couple things. One, I need you to send me some pics of that Chicago crew, because I would love for the listeners to see it on the website so that I can link to it. Do you mind doing that?
Absolutely.
Awesome. That sounds amazing to me. Guys, I really enjoyed this, and I appreciate, negotiating the time zone differences and getting you to spend an hour or so with me. Real quick, do any of the three of you have any shout outs or plugs you want to get out there?
Hello, Perth Meta. You guys are great.
Absolutely.
Don't do it. It's just lies. Lies. They're all awful.
I hate all of you. I did have a funny story from round two that I failed to get to, if you want me to quickly put
please.
That up. So my other scheme was Hidden Martyrs, which I had taken on both dead doxies, because my brain, as I said, I'm new to Seamus, but my brain was like, oh, they've got regret trigger to keep them alive. They can pump out distracted to keep them alive. Yeah. So if one goes down, I'll be fine. But I very quickly realized that the one I'd thrown up the board to fight a Garion, that Garion had six distracted on it and just was unable to kill it. So I'm going, oh, crap, I've lost my scheme. What am I going to do? And then I had
you denied your own scheme.
I've ruined it. And I had this brilliant brainwave because Thune buried the other one. And I had a mindless zombie next to him, which could break it out. But I just paused and just went, I don't have to. I can let it die at the end of the game to score my point if I need to.
Very nice. Very nice.
So my opponent sort of like paused and realized I just had a mindless zombie standing next to that pillar doing nothing for like three turns. Just like, do it. Is she going to die? Is the other one going to die? Do I have to smash this? Or so that was quite a fun moment when he realized what was going on there.
That's very cool. It's funny when you play a game and things are so situational. It's amazing how many times something you've never even thought of comes up and you realize like, wow, you know, I've played this scheme before. I've played this strategy before. I've played against this crew before. But because of the circumstances that have piled up, I figured out a whole new way to score in this game that I've never thought of before.
It was wonderfully fun.
That's great. All right, guys. And for those of you that stuck around to the end, thanks for listening. Take care.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch so you don't miss the avalanche of content we create. Links are in the show notes. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest in gaming apparel and gear. There you'll also find the latest information for the U.S. Faux Tour. Find out where you rank in your conference or even in the entire United States. Get those models built, painted, and ready so we can see you at the next US Faux Tour Masters event. Please take a moment to write a review of this pod on your favorite platform. Rating and reviewing helps us find more listeners almost as cool as you are. Be sure to share this feed with all of your friends who love tabletop gaming. Thanks for listening.
Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast.
Good job, guys. Good job. You and I might have to bug you when I finally do my Reva deep dive if you're up for
it. Please do. I'd be happy to. Awesome. Love her.
That makes me happy. So kind of what I was thinking here is when you guys listen to podcasts or, you know, watch battle reports, I'd be curious to know if there's things that you guys discuss in your meta saying, you know, boy, you know, everybody in UK thinks this is good and it's garbage, or everybody thinks this is garbage, it's good, or our style of play is this and it doesn't appear like the rest of the world does it that way. I'd like to find out whether there's certain things that you guys, you know, really think is uniquely Western Australia. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I know that we do sometimes give a bit of shit to the Americans, but like, you know, we have to. We're Australians. We're going to do that.
Well, I mean, that's all we did in 2E was make fun of each other. And why should that stop in third edition?
A proud tradition.
It is a proud tradition. I agree. All right, guys, I'll bring us back. All right. Very efficient, guys. Thank you.
Sorry, I am. I might be asking you to repeat yourself just because I'm getting a lot of dropout and it's really annoying. Apologies.
Okay, that's fine, James. Yeah, that's fine. The miracle of editing, we're going to sound so good.
I miss that. Sorry.
Don't worry. You can never make me sound good.
Yeah. And the other thing that's good about the Squadcast, James, is it's recording everything locally. So Rebecca's being recorded on her own computer. And so what'll happen is when we finish this, it's going to upload all of your local files to me. So there's going to be no latency, no dropouts or anything. It'll be nice.
Cool. Oh, that is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just technology.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, there's a million ways for me to record this podcast for free. I find Squadcast worth it because it's a better sounding podcast. Compared to, you can tell when someone's recording on Discord or Skype. And it's just better local. All right. All right. So matchups. What's that, James?
I didn't notice you're using a different program from last time I did this.
Similar idea though. So when you were on last, we used Zencaster, which is the same concept. Just Squadcast is better. At twice the price. So it better be better. All right. So any matchups between the three of you in round two?
Nope.
All different people? Nope. All right, good.
Yep.
So Rebecca, we'll start with you, okay?
Oh, okay. Yep.
Well done. Well done. God, I am so envious of you guys. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, we're really lucky here because Victoria is not doing so well, which is state of East, but WA and a couple of others. So we're just, yeah, like there's, like as Ewan said, there's venue caps, but aside from that, that's pretty much, yeah, we're fine.
Now, did you guys have a period of actual lockdown?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
When did that start for you guys?
I want to say March.
Early March.
And then it lasted. Yeah, early March. Then it lasted. Like, we locked down pretty fast because our premier is didn't want to take any chances. He was like, we're just going to lock down. And it lasted for about a month and a half, I want to say.
Yeah. I think we had the border lockdown and the regional lockdown within about a week of things getting serious with the virus. And then we went to
even before it started here.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Then just, it sounds like just naturally by geography, you guys had a bit of an advantage.
Big desert on one side, big ocean on the other. We're pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, very, very cool. All right, guys, I will bring us back to round one. In round one, did any of the three of you play each other?
Me and James did.
Okay. So what I'll do, you and I'll start with you. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go into Rebecca and James's, match, okay?
No worries.
All right, cool. James Bryant and Rebecca. I forgot to ask you, Leahy or Leahy?
Lay, actually.
Lay, not even close.
Yeah, nice job, Greg.
And Rebecca Lay.
Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over. And you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast too while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.